You're all right if I tape recorded our conversation.
Yeah, sure. Just tell me again what you're doing and what it's about.
Yeah, you bet. Okay, great.
I'll do my best to remember it.
Okay, great. Well, let me begin with a comment that you just made. You said you got involved. Is that a weighted word?
No, these were fairly high profile things we did at the time. So,
yeah.
And I think what I ended up doing, they were also filmed, so they became sort of mini, I think, 60-minute documentaries as well.
Uh-huh.
And I was the guy that that actually looked at all the tape, because we had various, I think we had three different camera crews moving around. So I was the only guy who sort of saw every minute of the thing.
Right.
At various times, these groups would break off and have separate discussions. So because I'd seen all the footage, I knew this stuff inside out, and I pulled it together. And I kind of, the piece I wrote, I think, both times. Well, we did this route with Fisher a couple of times. Both on constitutional issues and once on a deficit reduction measure.
Uh-huh. And were those before or after the people's verdict?
I'm trying to remember. I think the first one was the people's verdict.
Uh-huh.
And then we reconvened the group. This is why I laughed, because it became... The thing had aired at the documentary as well, and the egos grew around this thing, which was kind of interesting. But, yeah, I think the second one was filmed as well. So there were two on the Constitution. And then there was one which was done with a different group, which didn't use Roger Fisher's group, but was done on, I think, on deficit reduction.
Mm-hmm.
At a time when the deficit was becoming a big political issue here, and the questions, it sort of went beyond this to talk about how you might, where you would actually cut and how you would make those decisions.
Right.
That one wasn't as successful, I think. My recollection being that it was a bit, that one seemed to be more of an artificial push to a resolution.
Uh-huh.
I mean, much more moderator-driven in that case.
Uh-huh.
Whereas I think the people's verdict and the one that followed on, Canadians are pretty well versed in constitutional matters.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not at the level of lawyers, but at the level of all the pressure points. So they can always get together and talk about these things. There's kind of a code that works. So the moderator plays the real moderator's role. I think on something more technical, like deficit reduction and budgeting, you might be able to do it more easily now with people, but at that stage, I seem to remember that the moderator basically pushed for a solution.
Uh-huh.
It was a little, there was more artifice around that one.
Uh-huh. Well, let's back up just a bit. Could you tell me whose idea the People's Verdict was and what the genesis of that project was?
Our editor at that time, his name is Kevin Doyle,
uh-huh.
D-O-Y-L-E. Kevin's
yep.
now with Bloomberg, out of Toronto, Bloomberg News. But he was the editor of McLean's at the time. That was for about 10 years. And it was, frankly, I think it was his idea. I think he became aware. He could tell. I can get a number for you for Kevin.
Excellent.
Tell
okay.
You how Fisher's work came to his attention. And I mean, Kevin was very good at these ambitious things for the magazine to take on.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of his strengths. And he, the country was covering constitutional issues to death, and they were, you know, it was, there was a need to come at some things in a fresh way, and also to try to remove some of the elitism around the issue,
mm-hmm.
Because the country is moving towards a referendum.
Mm-hmm.
To the best of my knowledge, it was his idea.
His idea.
And right. Through force of personality, he made it work.
Uh-huh.
I think it was quite risky internally, corporately, too.
How so?
I think it required a fair bit of money for us. And,
uh-huh.
And it was new. And no one really knew how it would work out.
You know, when I looked at that, it occurred to me that such an initiative in any society, including any democracy, would be risky for another reason, too, which is that obviously it's going much more directly to the governed and asking for their input than often modern governmental institutions are able to do.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel any risk in that regard? You know?
Oh, yeah, there was. I mean, that the whole thing could have blown up and you could have come up with a verdict that was unworkable?
Yeah, this is what I'm thinking of. I'm obviously, even though I live just below the Canadian border, I'm not nearly as intimate with Canadian politics as I am with U.S. politics.
Yeah.
But it's been a very hot issue in this country for 20 years and more about the role of vested interests, lobbyists, et cetera, in establishing policy.
Yeah.
And there's constant chafing in this country over that. And, you know, some pretty high-profile journalists have commented on it. oh, I'm just blanking on her name, the political writer at the New Yorker, wrote a very searching piece a few years ago called Money and Politics.
Yeah.
And it really illuminated the extent to which the people's work is not being done in, mm-hmm. in the Congress in this country. And so I looked at this project and I thought, my goodness, here's a powerful national magazine who says, we're going to go directly to the people mm-hmm. and ask them what they want and then serve up that agenda for all to see. And I thought it was visionary and...
I'm trying to think what that taps into in terms of traditions here. I mean, Quebec had a referendum in 1980. You're aware of, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
With huge turnout. That's sort of the most prominent referendum. But on these very issues in terms of how to make a new constitutional arrangement, in 92 we had another national referendum here. And again with very, very high voter turnout.
And these were over separatist issues.
Yeah, yeah. Basically the first one was the actual question the first time around for Quebec was, do you give the government a mandate to negotiate a new arrangement with Canada?
Mm-hmm.
Which was rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Then the 92 national referendum I referred to was one on, there was a proposal for a new constitutional arrangement which involved all kinds of issues for various regions like Senate reform, and there was something for sort of every interest group, and it was defeated, but again with a high turnout. And then of course Quebec turned around and did it again in 97, I guess it was. I mean, the voter participation in 97, I think, was 92 or 93%. I mean, that was the turnout. It was really, really high.
So in that regard, it was not an exercise of the magazine getting way out ahead of society.
The referendums in this country, there had been one on conscription during the Second World War, and then there was the Quebec referendum. We don't have a lot of examples of sort of equivalent to proposition, you know, the way the California legislatures have done it, or the way sort of Colorado tax on gun referendums onto other ballots. We don't have that kind of tradition. So there have mm-hmm. just been big sort of pivotal issue ones mm-hmm. before. There's the Second World War conscription issue, and then the 80 Quebec one. Then we did this project. But I think this was more an exercise of, I think the intellectual basis of this exercise was the notion that you can have conflict, that there's a process of conflict resolution and a school of conflict resolution that allows you to move towards consensus from what seemed to be intractable positions.
Mm-hmm.
That was more of the drive as opposed to this notion of consulting people.
Mm-hmm.
The Reform Party, for example, which has grown up out of Western Canada, which began as a movement and has now become the official opposition, although it seems to have stalled in terms of growth, they are very heavily based on the notions of referendum, the right of recall. That's very much part of their ethic and their culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a foreign concept.
Do you have a sense of what the hope was at the magazine? In doing this piece, I mean, was it anything beyond kind of a conventional reporting objective?
In terms of outcome?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have a preferred outcome?
Not a preferred outcome, but was there a hope that this exercise could contribute to the process of dialogue, governance,
oh, yeah.
et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, very much so. I think the feeling was that you... if you can demonstrate that it works on an individual level, that people can come together, they can move beyond entrenched positions and come
uh-huh.
to consensual understanding, that you can set a model for people.
Uh-huh.
So people were chosen because they weren't just chosen at random out of a phone book, and they were chosen carefully because they represented a demographic political group.
Right. Yeah, I saw that. It was a very sophisticated exercise.
Yeah, that was key to it. I mean, you didn't want 12 like-minded people. You wanted people that came, that showed you how difficult it was, but then you believed that you could bridge it.
Mm-hmm. And how did you feel?
I think if it had fallen apart, it may not have been the outcome we would have wanted, but I think our instructions as journalists there were to cover this like it was a meeting, to cover it like journalists. Those
mm-hmm.
were that was our assignment. So
mm-hmm.
Had it fallen apart, we would have covered that as well, too.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have swept it under the rug if it had missed.
I beg your pardon?
We wouldn't have swept it under the rug if it had missed.
Right. Did it have any noticeable impact in the country?
I mean, I guess the short answer would be no, because the referendum based on many of the same principles, failed nationally. I mean, you just can't incubate anyway. Those things get caught up in all sorts of other issues, and so the referendum became complicated by personalities and other political agendas. So I wouldn't say it's a fair test of it, but I guess if you had to objectively look at it, did it have a positive impact or not? No, it probably didn't move that along. They were very, they got an enormous amount of attention.
Among the public, among government
among
officials?
Among the public and the elites as well. And I think the second time we did it, we had, I'm trying to think if we had as facilitators in there. We brought some politicians in. We had Dorothy Dolby, who was at that time kind of a mid-level Tory politician, and David Peterson, who was a former Premier of Ontario. But no, it got a lot of attention. And also because it was shown as well as a documentary, which was really quite nicely shot. We had it, we had good locations for it, and then there were some good human moments of conflict and then of resolution as well.
Right.
It was good. It was good television. I would never have believed it could have made a good television.
And it was broadcast nationally?
Yes, it was. Uh-huh. Yeah. The filmmaker, I think I have his number here. Do you want this?
Yes, please.
Just go ahead and I'll hunt for it.
Okay. So your perception is that both the elites and the public were enthusiastic about the process, and was there some excitement about it, some hope for its potential in improving public dialogue and governance?
You know, I don't remember quite detailed enough in terms of how people specifically reacted at the time, so I wouldn't want to mislead you at all. There was this was a big issue in the country that we cut down a lot of trees to write about and burned up a lot of hours on television about. So I think while what we did was different and distinct, it wasn't operating in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of noise about this at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember that guy's name. I will get it for you.
Okay.
What the hell?
Was there any editorial follow-up? What did you folks do after this particular package ran?
I'm trying to think what we did the next week. I think we let it pretty much go as a standalone and then reconvened the group minus one person. The next year. And we all sort of had it down by then about how to do it. But I think again, we covered it like a journalistic event. That was, as the guy writing the main piece, that was the way I approached it. Let's just pretend this is a real thing and just cover it.
Do you recall if at the time after you completed your reporting of the event, you had any sense of what ultimate social impact it might have in the country? Did you have any expectations?
No, I have my own sort of personal beliefs about accommodation. It was nice to see something that could prove the ability to extract tolerance from people in that kind of a setting. I wasn't Pollyannish about it, though.
Right. On paper, as you read this package, it gives the appearance of the potential for turbocharged democracy. In other words, you can meld all of this expertise. You can use powerful statistical sampling methodology. You can use the state-of-the-art conflict negotiation methodology. In other words, you can profile the psyche of a society, and you can shepherd its dialogue about volatile issues, and you can get to a place where society is not now routinely getting just about anywhere in the world. It's a very hopeful and promising looking exercise on paper. And I'm just wondering, is there something that I'm missing? And
no, I think what it might have triggered were, and we may have, you'd have to ask Kevin, actually. We may have actually called for, I'm forgetting the term, for some reason, at my age, drawing a blank on a term where basically you convene a meeting of citizens, a forum of citizens. There was a lot of this, actually, you know, in a way, I'm not saying this contributed to it, but in a way there was it was on or slightly ahead of this wave of anti-elitism that was very, very predominant in Canada in the early 90s and grew into real strength in the 93 election that really whacked elites around and persists to a more, it's more benign these days, but still is very much part of the Canadian political culture. Because Canadian political culture has always been fairly elitist. I mean, the country was founded and for a long time did its business simply by elites getting together in back rooms and knocking things out.
Mm-hmm.
The reaction against this constitutional deal eventually evolved to the point where people said, you can't let your elites disappear off behind closed doors and make deals. You can't exclude the people from the process. So in that sense, it really struck a chord. And that was a very strong wish. I mean, that's one of the large, the defining reasons why the Tories got turfed so brutally from power in 93 was this perception that they were elitist and that anti-establishment feeling really coalesced in that time. That's where the Reform Party comes from, and that's where they drew their strength in this notion of referendum and recall and, you know, the ability to tell your MP how to vote on your behalf and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could remember that. What is the term when you convene a? I mean, what was it? What did they call the group of people that gathered to write the U.S. Constitution? you know, there's
right,
a,
right. Yeah, I'm blanking on it too.
Man. Anyway, the just while I have it here, the filmmaker's name is Peter Raymond, Raymont.
Uh-huh.
He's in Toronto at 416-505-6001.
6001.
Yeah.
And do you know how long the entire documentary was?
It's 60 minutes.
Oh, it's just a single 60-minute long documentary.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I assume that tape is available for sale now?
Oh, I think Peter will be able to zip you a copy pretty quickly. Yeah.
Great.
That
okay.
wouldn't work.
Great.
And Kevin Doyle, who really was just the prime driver in this thing. He's in Toronto as well at 416-364-7718.
7718. Great. Did you have any discussion with Fisher and his team afterwards? Do you have a sense of how they felt about the exercise?
Yeah, Fisher was very proud of what he'd accomplished.
Uh-huh.
He wanted a deal by deadline time, which was a Sunday.
Uh-huh.
If he asked me, he may have cut some corners to get there on time. It was very tough to get a deal.
Uh-huh.
It really was very, very tough. When we came through the Saturday night, I mean, that stuff in there, in the story, it wasn't there to make the story look better, that sort of we got to the brink of disaster and crawled back. I really thought it was going to break up.
Uh-huh.
So he was pretty euphoric. His people operated in, I don't know if this is the best, his people were operating in Yugo, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
And a couple other places.
I noticed that in the credentials that were included in the story.
I don't know if I'd be putting that on my calling card, actually.
Yeah.
To be fair. Now, do you know Fisher at all?
I have a call into him. I do not. I mean, I'm somewhat familiar with his work.
Yeah.
But no, I've never spoken with him. What were you thinking?
Strong personality.
Strong personality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is his methodology obviously it's widely used, and his book has been seen as a Bible for years.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly that approach to dialogue is not routine in the world today.
No, it's not.
Does it have more potential than we're experiencing right now, based on what you saw there?
Yeah, I liked it. You know, I'm It's a pretty basic concept, and I don't know what kind of language and sort of hokum language you put around it. I think it's pretty, it's a good concept, and the way he operates, it's very good to see it demonstrated, even if it's an obvious thing. I think once you see it demonstrated to you, you then embrace it a little bit more firmly, because I mean, what he does is he shows how two opposing views, if they don't move, are doomed to collide for an infinite amount of time. I mean, you will, you know, he demonstrates to you how powerfully you feel about your arguments, and then makes you understand that the other side feels equally powerfully about theirs.
Right.
And then says, since you're not about to give, why do you think they're about to give? And so therefore, why can't we find some third way, some alternate path? Let's consider what's... it's not simply a question of you got to give up this, you got to give up that. It's let's find another way and stop banging heads, which all makes eminent sense and takes about 10 seconds to describe, but it's valuable for people who are involved in a negotiation to see that happen. And I think it's applicable whether it's countries coming apart or how to resolve an office dispute to a certain degree.
Right. One thing that emerges quite clearly in your reporting is the emotion that people seem to feel after the breakthrough and in the conclusion of the exercise. Do you recall that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Couldn't stop them from hugging.
Yeah. What was that about?
I don't
know. Where did that emotion come
from? I don't know. It was extraordinary to see, but I think it was real. Some of these people stayed in touch with each other after.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if they still do.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it was hard to be cynical about, you know. I mean, they were, because they're not playing to a constituency or anything. They're not, you know, it's not like there's a vote in it for them or something.
Right.
In fact, the more than anything, considering they were going to be on television back home, was the risk of looking silly or something. So
right.
It was pretty real and truly felt, and that was a good weekend.
The thing that I wondered about in reading the package is whether this methodology gives people a way of gaining release from the prisons of perception. In other words, when we hold a view about something, it's not just an intellectual, rational phenomenon in which we've added up all the facts and said, well, you know, this is 2 + 2 + 2, and this is the answer. There are other elements that contribute to our filters, our way of knowing the world, and many of us frequently experience that as a prison. I mean, I wonder what the people of Yugoslavia are feeling now. You know, to be grappling with these ancient animosities the way they are, and now dealing with the animosities of NATO. And my speculation about that emotion was, do you think it was because they experienced a freeing of perception somehow? Or was it just the warmth of reconciliation?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it's not a Yugo-style prison for them, right? Because they're... I mean, in addition to all the other identity politics that Yugoslavia's got right now, there's the real physical fear component, which is not present for these people at all. There was nobody was physically threatened by this. That's, you know, the most dangerous thing you'll get in Canadian constitutional politics is sort of a lawyer mad at you kind of thing. So they don't have that constraint. So there isn't that sense of relief from fear that might contribute to it. Except that, I mean, people came together and they kind of liked one another. And maybe it's just nicer to agree than to walk away mad.
Right.
People are looking for, they may be looking for ways to get along as opposed to looking for ways to break up.
Uh-huh.
So a sense of happiness at finding that. I mean, let's face it also, I mean, Canadians, I mean, I wouldn't want to downplay the regional differences or try to deny them because they're all real and they're all there, but in the grand wash of life, you know, we're pretty much alike.
Right, right.
And for all the differences that sort of Francophone Quebecers and Anglophone Quebecers like to think about themselves as well. They're also very much alike. So.
Right.
And that's not to deny the differences. I don't deny them or say they're all fabrics of fabrication or parts of people's imagination. They're real.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a leap. You know.
In the video, as it aired, were they able to capture both the conflict and the ultimate resolution?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I've only seen it once, but yeah, I mean, talked to Peter. No, I think Peter, as a filmmaker, was pretty happy with
the
emotion that he got on camera. As I say, it was quite extraordinary to be able to watch something on the Constitution that didn't want to make you reach for the clicker.
Right. Have you had any follow-up with the participants?
No, they've written a couple of times. When I did, I did foreign news for about 7 years after that. When I was overseas, got a couple of letters from people that said they liked the stuff and stuff.
Uh-huh.
A fair bit of time has passed. I don't know where they all are. One of the fellows, Colin, who I think became Colin after the Gulf War, moved to the States.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't a part of the second group because he couldn't get back.
Would there be any way for me to track those folks down, do you suppose?
I'm sure there's some set of phone numbers in there. I mean, the other thing, these people were very well treated as well. I mean,
right.
They were flown in. It was a nice weekend. They were given gifts. They became minor media celebs for a while.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was a great experience. The second one was a little... It was okay, but it was a little less... It had a different atmosphere to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The first one was real.
Right. Yeah, I
suppose. The first one was good because it was just such a. It was such a long bomb, you know. It's just a Hail Mary kind of thing that Kevin put up there.
Right. Right.
And it worked.
Huh. What would you suggest to me is the best way to see who might maintain phone numbers and contacts for them? Anybody at the magazine?
Yeah, she'll kill me, but her name's Christine Johnson.
Okay, I have a call into her. That's the...
Ask Chris,
okay.
Yeah, she was involved in that one. She's the assistant to Bob Lewis, the editor.
Right.
Bob was managing editor at the time.
Right.
And so
right.
Chris made all the arrangements.
Right, great, okay.
Yeah. You can tell her we talked to him.
Okay.
You can say that... I predict she will just reach for ulcer medication.
Okay.
Well, she had to deal with them all.
Uh-huh. Well, I left a long message on her machine, so I'm...
You may never hear from her.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
Just keep calling.
Right.
She's a very good person.
All right, sir. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Wallace, for taking this time to visit
anytime.
With me.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you do at the end, I mean, let us just sort of generally McLean's know if you can. If just,
I sure you know, will. In fact... I'm just going to issue, I'm not exactly sure what Tom is going to do with this. He's just asking for an internal report for me. I think he is going to be doing some writing about this, so we'd be happy to route it to you.
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a mailing address?
Yeah, or I mean, if you want, do you want an internet address?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Probably the easiest electronically.
Okay.
It's just B. Wallace at McLean's, without the apostrophe. .ca.
Very good.
All right.
We'll get you a copy.
Great.
All right. Thanks so much, sir.
No sweat. And actually, also, I'm not sure if that stuff's on our website, our website goes back far enough, but you might want to look at the second installment of that if you haven't seen it.
You know, I tried to, I hunted for your website just briefly a minute ago and didn't get it up, so I will go back.
You didn't get any? It's McLean's.ca.
Right.
That's all it is.
And I had an apostrophe in there, so...
Yeah, keep that open.
Very good. Thanks a lot.
No sweat.
Bye.
Bye.